Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. I'm Jorge Salazar. We interview the world's top scientists. This week, we'll tell you about the most distant galaxy ever seen, assassin bugs, and how to find Venus before dawn. First, a scientist soundbite.
We'll start to see more and more systems that can look at social behavior and how we are interacting and making friends. So I would say in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see huge changes.
That was Tanzeem Chowdhury talking about smartphone applications or apps of the future. More and more people these days have a cell phone, and many of us own smartphones, an iPhone, for example, or an Android. Lindsay Patterson spoke to a scientist who's using data from smartphones to model human behavior, that is, looking for patterns in people's everyday lives. Here's Lindsay to tell us more.
Thanks, Jorge. Like you said, cell phones are so ubiquitous now. They're all over the world. Tanzeem Chowdhury, a computer scientist at Dartmouth, is figuring out ways to collect and use data from our phones, specifically smartphones.
So my research primarily focuses on building people-aware systems. By this, what I mean is that I build computational systems that continuously capture and understand people's lives and their behavior, what activities they're engaged in, how they engage with others. And the goal is to understand life patterns of individuals, groups, and broader societies. And we're interested in building these systems using computers that we carry with us all the time, which are our cell phones.
And so how do these computational systems, our cell phones, how do they become aware of human activities and interactions and relationships, all those things that you want to find out about?
So if we think about how humans do that, right, we understand and become aware of what's going on using our sights and sounds. So phones can use its eyes and ears or its sensors. And some of these sensors are similar to our sensors. So we have audio and video that captures what's going on around us. Some are different. For example, GPS that can tell us about location or motion sensors that tell us about how things are moving. And what we do is build computer algorithms that take these traces and waves and build algorithms that can interpret and find patterns. So for example, when people are walking, they take steps at a certain pace. So we want to build algorithms can detect that pattern. Or when we interact or have conversations with one another, again, there is certain kind of pattern in the sound wave that we generate, and we want to build algorithms that can detect and classify those patterns and recognize as human speech or conversation.
And how would this information be used?
So what we are interested in is building kind of system that can help in tracking individuals' mental, physical, and cognitive health. So if we think about human behavior, physical activities can affect heart health, or if how we carry out tasks in the home can also reveal information about whether an elderly individual is experiencing cognitive decline, or how we engage with others socially can reveal information about mental health. So we are building systems that could help individuals keep track of their health and hopefully use that as an early warning system if something goes wrong. We're also working with doctors to better understand how we can capture information about people's behaviors and lifestyle to understand and manage health problems.
That's a lot of information that can come from our cell phones. But isn't it a little creepy that cell phones know where you are, how you're walking and talking?
Definitely. There are certainly privacy concerns. And the way that Dr. Chowdhury's team is addressing that is by building in the option to opt out of certain features. And their app wouldn't actually record your conversations. It would just interpret the patterns of your speech.
So if someone does want this, when might they be able to download it?
Well, Chowdhury said that in about 5 to 10 years, we're going to see a lot of phone applications that use sensors in this way, and they're just going to get more and more sophisticated.
Thanks, Lindsay.
You're welcome.
Earth Sky's Lindsay Patterson, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
On the way downtown.
Find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. Ryan Britton has a weird science story currently circulating the internet. The assassin bug of Australia has a unique way of hunting and catching spiders in their own webs. Ryan, spin this tale for us.
Sure. Today I have an interesting, weird story about the assassin bug. It's a hunter of spiders that ever so gently plucks the strands at the outer edges of a spider's web to mimic the last throes of a dying bug. It's basically the sound of easy prey for a spider. But instead of the spider striding over and finding a meal, the spider itself becomes the meal.
So the spider becomes the hunted.
That's right. That's right. And that's what's so interesting here is that researchers compared the responses of these spiders to, say, real prey, a real bug caught in a spider web, to the falling of leaves on the web, to the arrival of courting male spiders, as well as the response to the assassin bugs themselves. And what they found was that the spiders ignored the leaves. They assumed the mating position for male spiders. And of course, they went after the prey to eat. So most relevant here is that the researchers observed these spiders approaching the assassin bugs much in the same way that they approach their prey.
So what else did these researchers find, Ryan?
Well, they analyzed the vibrations associated with these different events. And the vibrations of the assassin bug, you know, again, standing there plucking the strands at the edge of a spider's web, most closely resembled the dying and defeated sort of last throes of an actual prey, something that the spider could eat. Sometimes bugs get caught in a web and, you know, they thrash about and the spider comes running over aggressively to subdue the prey. So this could be very dangerous for the assassin bug. But again, that gentle plucking by the assassin bug seems to say to the spider, you know, hey, you know, no hurry. I'm almost dead. I'm yours. And then bam, the spider becomes the prey. It's pretty cool.
Thanks, Ryan. Where can people find out more about this story on the assassin bug?
Well, the assassin bug has what's probably an unofficial Facebook page. So you can visit the assassin bug on Facebook to get more details and friend it. Also, you can find some more information at Scientific American at SIAM.com, where they have a short podcast on the assassin bug, and also at DiscoveryNews.com at news.discovery.com.
Thanks, Ryan, for some weird science.
Thank you.
Animal behaviors in the everyday, each and every city, state, county, country, avenue, and driveway. Rational behaviors make the system tick, makes the human do the trick. Earn the pay, procreate, and quick fade. Animal behaviors.
You're listening to EarthSky, a clear voice for science. You'll find us as EarthSky on Facebook, EarthSky Science on Twitter, and at EarthSky.org. And now a story about a galaxy far, far away and a long time ago. European astronomers have found the oldest object yet seen in the universe, which they think is 13.1 billion years old, formed shortly after the Big Bang that created the entire universe. The galaxy is called UDFY38135539. Here on the line to tell us more is Matthew Leonard of the Paris Observatory, lead astronomer on the Discovery team. Dr. Leonard, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, it's reported that you discovered the oldest thing in the universe ever observed by humans. Please tell us what you found.
Well, I think the word discovered is probably a bit exaggerated because the object originally came from very deep imaging from the Hubble Space Telescope. And what we did is we used a very large telescope in Chile to actually observe the light from this galaxy in what we call with a spectrograph. And that means we just take the light and we split it by its wavelength. And so we can determine more properties of the galaxy. And by measuring that light, we actually can tell how far away it is, or alternatively, how long ago this object existed. Because you have to remember that distance and time in the universe are virtually one and the same. That means as we look at things that are very far away, we're also seeing them as they were a long time ago.
What does this galaxy tell us
about the early universe. What was the universe like back then, 13.1 billion years ago?
Well, that's a really good question, actually, because, in fact, that's the important part, because the universe back then, 13.1 billion years ago, was actually not very much like it is today. And the reason for this is perhaps a little bit complicated, but I think it's kind of worth going through maybe the early history of the universe, which I think your listeners might find fascinating. Now, keep in mind, there's a lot of uncertainty in this, but this is the general picture of what we think happened. So there was a Big Bang, a primordial explosion that created the space and the time in which we live. And then after that happened and the universe expanded, it cooled. And, you know, initially it was a sea of particles of various types. But as it cooled, it formed the common sort of particles we know of in our local universe today, like protons and electrons and neutrons. And as it cooled in fact to about 3,000 degrees, these sort of ordinary, as you might call them, particles combined to form, for example, a proton and electron combined to form a hydrogen atom. And the protons and neutrons and some electrons combined to form helium atoms. So at that point, the universe, and this is after about 300,000 years after the Big Bang, became a sea of hydrogen and helium atoms. And then as the universe grew older and older, keep in mind it's still very young compared to today's age of 13.7 billion years, the gas began to collapse and cool as it collapsed, and it formed these first galaxies. So as these first galaxies formed, they began to emit light that actually turned the universe back into its previous earlier state of being ionized, as we call it. In other words, it was instead of a soup of hydrogen and helium atoms, it became a soup of protons and electrons again. And because of that, we can say that the universe went through a dramatic phase change. It means these first galaxies, like the one we observed at this redshift in the early universe, actually created a change in the entire structure of the universe by reverting it back to this, as we call it, ionized state, where it's composed of protons and electrons. And this is the gas between galaxies now. And so this is what this galaxy UDFY-38135539 is important, because we're actually observing galaxies when they're in the middle of this process of creating the changing the universe from being mostly hydrogen and helium atoms between the galaxies to one where actually it's mostly protons and electrons between the galaxies. And this is really quite dramatic, because these first galaxies literally changed the universe in which they lived. It also means that the way these galaxies formed was also different than a galaxy may form now in the local universe, or how a galaxy might evolve now in the local universe, because the conditions in which it lives is actually dramatically different than it was 13.1 billion years ago. So I think that's sort of the importance of this finding.
That was astronomer Matthew Leonard speaking by phone from the Paris Observatory. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Taking your questions on Facebook. To find us on Facebook, search for Earth Sky. Many listeners have probably heard of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. It's a large region of floating trash in the northern Pacific Ocean. Now, scientists say there's a counterpart in the North Atlantic. Earth Sky's Emily Howard joins us now to talk about the North Atlantic Garbage Patch.
I recently spoke with Dr. Kara Lavender Law, and she's been studying this region of floating trash for the past few years. And she says that this garbage patch is located between the latitudes of Cuba and the U.S. state of Virginia, and it's made up mostly of small pieces of plastic that are no larger than a pencil eraser. Now, this trash is carried by currents from all over the northern Atlantic and brought together in what's called an ocean gyre. Now, what that is that's a system of rotating currents that bring together and then entrap the floating debris. So basically, what we have here is a stagnant pool of junk that is just hanging out in the North Atlantic. Dr. Law explains best.
In most parts of the ocean, you see very little to zero plastic floating. And these regions are special because of the currents that carry the floating plastic debris and other types of debris to those particular regions.
Dr. Law told me that back in the 1970s, research ships towing the surface of the Atlantic for plankton started pulling up pieces of plastic in their nets. So for the last 20 years now, scientists have been studying the North Atlantic garbage patch.
The vast majority of the debris is very, very small pieces that we collect in the nets, but you certainly do see recognizable items from the deck of the ship. You see bottles, jugs, toothbrushes, fishing gear, and it's fairly shocking to see these common household items drifting by thousands of miles from shore.
And there are actually 5 major ocean gyres in the world, those being, again, these rotating current systems. And all of these are located, the major ones at least, in the North and South Pacific, the North and South Atlantic, as well as the Indian Ocean. And Dr. Law says that there is probably a garbage patch in each of these, but that so far scientists have only actually looked in the North Atlantic and the North Pacific Oceans. And as the pieces are so small in the North Atlantic garbage patch, cleaning it up would require filtering this huge expanse of ocean, which, while unlikely because of the sheer magnitude of the endeavor, is also not a very good idea because, while eliminating the trash, it would also eliminate a lot of the microscopic creatures that are living there and that are so essential to the food chain. So, until a reasonable solution is come upon, Dr. Law advises reduce, reuse, recycle.
Thanks, Emily.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard. And you're listening to Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Back after this. Sky, heard on 1,500 radio stations around the world. Next, we have Deborah Bird here to talk about the global night sky. Welcome, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
What have you got for us?
Well, Jorge, I know you're a night owl, but you're going to have to get up early to see what I'm talking about.
So you know me well. Early? How early are we talking about?
Well, before sunrise, just before dawn breaks in the east. If you do that, if you face east before sunrise, you'll be able to see the planet Venus, and you'll also have an opportunity to picture yourself riding on planet Earth in orbit around the sun.
That's cool. Venus is known as the morning star and the planet of love.
That's right. When it's up before dawn, people call Venus the morning star, but it is a planet in our solar system, the brightest planet we see from Earth. That's probably why early stargazers named Venus for their goddess of love.
But wait a second, didn't I just see Venus after sunset?
You did. This very bright planet was in the west after sunset for much of 2010.
So why did Venus switch from one part of the sky to another?
Well, remember, Venus is moving in orbit around the sun, and Jorge, you and I and everyone listening are also riding on a planet that's moving in orbit. Venus orbits closer to the sun than we do, and it's a feature of our solar system, and probably all solar systems, that the closer a planet is to the sun, the faster it moves in orbit. So every so often, Venus gains a lap on us and passes between us and the sun. That just happened on October 29th, and when that happens, Venus moves from one part of our sky to the other, in this case from our evening to our morning sky. Venus is just coming out of the sunrise now before dawn. It's a very lovely sight. People from all around the globe have been telling us that they're beginning to see Venus now before dawn. Just remember, it's very bright. You'll be surprised at how bright it is for being so low in the sky. Venus will be getting brighter throughout November, and it'll be at its brightest in early December, when it'll be near the waning crescent moon. So start watching now. If you see it in the east before daybreak, come to our Facebook page. We're Earth Sky on Facebook, and let us know.
Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. That's our show. Thanks for joining us on Earth Sky. This week's show was recorded at the Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. And special thanks this week to our musical contributors, the Frontier Brothers, The Boxing Lesson, Monahans, Leatherbag, 100 Flowers, and The Black and White Years. For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists with too much heart and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.